Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. New York, this is Democracy Now! Bangladesh's prime minister has resigned and fled to India after weeks of student-led protests. We'll get an update from Amnesty International. Then, as tension rises over the contested results of Venezuela's presidential election, we'll host a debate between sociologist Edgardo Lander in Caracas and Nina Farnia, who is an election observer there with the National Lawyers Guild. Finally, a bombshell Washington Post investigation into whether Donald Trump took a $10 million bribe from the Egyptian government days before Trump took office.
We agree on so many things. I just want to let everybody know, in case there was any doubt, that we are very much behind President El-Sisi. He's done a fantastic job.
We'll speak with Washington Post reporter Carol Lenig, who broke the story. And we'll talk to a member of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows about why they supported a plea deal with the alleged mastermind of the 9/11 attacks that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin just revoked. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Bangladeshi Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina has resigned and fled to India after weeks of student-led protests. Bangladesh's army has announced an interim government will be formed to run Bangladesh. Earlier today, crowds stormed Hasina's official residence in Dhaka to celebrate her ouster. She'd led Bangladesh since 2009. Her father was Bangladesh's first president. On Sunday, police violently cracked down as tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets. Almost 100 people died on Sunday, bringing the death toll in recent weeks to over 300. Most of those killed have been student protesters. Hasina resigned as protesters vowed to defy a military curfew and stay in the streets.
Nobody can stop us from marching today. If we turn back and face them once, we will liberate Bangladesh. And I want to tell my armed forces, brothers, not to align with the autocrat. Either you're with the people or stay neutral.
We'll have more on Bangladesh after headlines. The U.S. has sent additional military forces, warships and fighter jets to the Middle East as Israel braces for a possible retaliatory attack by Iran and Hezbollah. Last week, Israel assassinated Hamas's political chief, Ismail Haniyeh, in Tehran, as well as a top Hezbollah commander in Beirut. A number of countries, including the U.S., France and the U.K., have urged their citizens to leave Lebanon as fears grow of a broader regional war. President Biden is planning to meet with his national security team today. In Gaza, at least 30 Palestinians were killed Sunday when Israel attacked two schools sheltering displaced people in Gaza City. Officials in Gaza said 80% of the victims were children. The attack came a day after Israel struck another school in Gaza City, killing 16 people. Israeli forces also attacked the courtyard of Deir Abbas al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, where displaced Palestinians were living in a makeshift tents, which caught on fire. At least five Palestinians died.
They said Al-Aqsa Hospital was safe, and we stayed in Al-Aqsa Hospital because it was supposed to be safe. We were sleeping, believing it was safe, and suddenly a rocket hit, setting the tent on fire. A woman who was this child's mother was killed. She was hit by a shrapnel in her back and died on the spot, martyred where she stood.
Israel also carried out airstrikes on the occupied West Bank Saturday, killing nine Palestinians in the city of Tulkarm. Hamas said three of the victims were members of its military wing. In the UK, unrest is growing following the deadly stabbing of three girls last week in the northwestern town of Southport. At least eight other children and two adults were injured in the attack on a children's dance class, many of them still in critical condition. The attack stoked violent far-right protests across Britain after early misinformation identified the suspect as an immigrant living in the UK without documentation. The 17-year-old suspect was, in fact, born in Cardiff to Rwandan parents. Over the weekend, rioters raided and set fire to hotels used to shelter asylum seekers in northern England. Violent protests also led to some 150 arrests, with incidents reported in Hull, Liverpool, Bristol and Belfast, among others. Anti-fascist protesters have also gathered to counter the white nationalists. On Sunday, Prime Minister Keir Starmer condemned the, quote, far-right thuggery.
People in this country have a right to be safe, and yet we've seen Muslim communities targeted, attacks on mosques, other minority communities singled out, Nazi salutes in the street, attacks on the police, wanton violence alongside racist rhetoric. So no, I won't shy away from calling it what it is, far-right thuggery.
The Democratic National Committee has announced Vice President Kamala Harris has won enough votes from delegates to secure the party's presidential nomination. The DNC is holding a virtual roll call ahead of the Democratic National Convention, which begins in 2 weeks in Chicago. Harris is expected to name her running mate today or tomorrow. Over the weekend, she interviewed three top candidates: Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, U.S. Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona, and Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro. She also met with Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg for 90 Minutes Friday. In other campaign news, Donald Trump has dropped out of a planned presidential debate on ABC scheduled for September 10th. Trump now says he'll debate Harris, but only if it's hosted by Fox News. In other Trump news, the Washington Post has revealed Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi may have secretly given Donald Trump a $10 million bribe in 2017. The Post reveals 5 days before Trump took office, an organization with ties to Egyptian intelligence withdrew $10 million in cash from the National Bank of Egypt in Cairo. According to the Post, former Attorney General William Barr helped block an FBI probe into the deal. We'll have more on the story later in the broadcast with Washington Post reporter Carol Lenig. In Sudan, the Rapid Support Forces killed at least 23 people Saturday in a shelling on the besieged North Darfur city of El Fasher, as the paramilitary group struggles to gain full control over Darfur. Aid groups warn the spiraling humanitarian catastrophe in Sudan could engulf the entire region after famine was declared in the Zamzam camp for displaced people located outside El Fasher. At least 10 million people have been displaced amid Sudan's brutal civil war. This is a woman at Zamzam.
Since we came to Zamzam, nothing has been provided to us by the organization, and we are suffering from lack of food, water, and everything else. But we are staying here, thank God, until now. We are eating simple food, thank God. We need water, food, health care, and for God to lift this curse from Sudan, nothing more than that.
In Somalia, at least 37 people were killed in an attack by al-Shabaab on a popular Mogadishu beach Friday night. The attack, carried out by a suicide bomber and gunmen, injured another 200 people. It's one of the deadliest attacks this year by the al-Qaeda-linked group. Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud has vowed, but so far failed, to eradicate al-Shabaab. Tensions are rising 1 week after the disputed Venezuelan election was called for incumbent President Nicolas Maduro. His main rivals, presidential candidate Edmundo Gonzalez and fellow opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, have repeatedly claimed their party received more votes, releasing its own tally of last Sunday's ballots. The U.S., Argentina, Ecuador, Costa Rica and Uruguay have recognized Edmundo Gonzalez as president-elect, while Mexico and Brazil are warning external actors against interfering in Venezuela's national affairs. Mass protests in support of Maduro took place across Venezuela this weekend. We'll go to Caracas for more later in the broadcast. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has revoked a plea deal for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and two other men held at Guantanamo accused of plotting the 9/11 attacks. Under the deal, the three prisoners had agreed to plead guilty and be sentenced to life in prison. But on Friday, Austin rescinded the deal in a move that will put the death penalty back on the table for the three men. We'll have more on this story later in the program. The Biden administration's announced the U.S. government will pay out more than $2 billion to thousands of black farmers and other farmers of color who are discriminated against by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. In a statement, President Biden said, quote, "For too long, many farmers and ranchers experienced discrimination in farm loan programs and have not had the same access to federal resources and support." And Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina are bracing for possible catastrophic flooding from Hurricane Debbie, which is expected to make landfall today in the Florida Big Bend area. Some areas could face up to 30 inches of rain in the coming days. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show with breaking news. Bangladeshi Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina has resigned and fled to India after weeks of student-led protests. Bangladesh's army has announced an interim government will be formed to run Bangladesh. Earlier today, crowds stormed Hasina's official residence in Dhaka to celebrate her ouster. Hasina had led Bangladesh since 2009. She also served as prime minister from 1996 to 2001. Her father was Bangladesh's first president. On Sunday, police violently cracked down as tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets. Almost 100 people died on Sunday, bringing the death toll in recent weeks to over 300. Most of those killed have been student protesters. Hasina resigned as protesters vowed to defy a military curfew and stay in the streets. For more, we go to London. We're joined by Takbir Huda, Amnesty International South Asia researcher who's been following all of this very closely. Takbir, thanks so much for joining us. Explain what has happened in Bangladesh, leading to the final ouster of the prime minister. She's fled to India and the deaths of hundreds of mainly Bangladeshi students.
Thanks, Amy. So, you know, the most interesting thing is that this started off as a protest for something really innocuous, which was a one-point demand against the quota system that the government had reintroduced. And then, because the government's heavy-handed response, first by its student wing, which attacks students in Dhaka University and in the hospital, and followed by this heavy-handed response by the security forces, it became a much wider movement. But even as recently as 20th July, when scores of people were killed, the protesters weren't calling for her resignation. They called for resignation of two high-level ministers. Even then, the authorities kept on cracking down on them. It's only on 3rd August, 2 days ago, that the protesters officially mobilized with a renewed one-point demand, which was the resignation of the prime minister. And it is amazing to see that they have materialized that demand in less than 2 days. And this just goes to show, if they had only sat with the students when they were peacefully protesting, all of this bloodshed could have been avoided, and this wouldn't have been the turnout, but they didn't. And so the students remained resilient and, put the final nail in the coffin.
And they are still protesting in the streets right now. Can you explain the shift in the role of the military, first serving Sheikh Hasina, the prime minister, and now saying that they're going to hand power over to an interim government?
Yes, so there was a perceptible shift in the role of the military, who in the initial spate of the killings did implement the shoot-on-site curfew orders. But when the protests resumed earlier last week, they seemed to have played a neutral role where they weren't really opening fire, but they weren't also protecting the protesters either, which is very different from the police, which have consistently executed the wishes of the executive. And this is because the police is far more partisan than the army. But right now, given Bangladesh's history with military, dictatorships in the first 20 years and followed by, military caretaker government, which last came in 2007, it's really important to stress that, this must be a time-bound measure that is only necessary until the publicly accountable form of governance can be reintroduced in Bangladesh. And I'll just add to this that there is a highly militarized region in Bangladesh known as the Chittagong Hill Tracts, and that must always be in the forefront of our concerns, because that remains the most militarized region in Bangladesh. And the people there, primarily indigenous people, remain living in highly deplorable and securitized conditions.
Takbir Huda, I want to thank you for being with us. We're going to continue to talk about this tomorrow on Democracy Now! As developments take place. He is Amnesty International's South Asia researcher. Next up, as tension rises over the contested results of Venezuela's presidential election, we'll host a debate with sociologist Edgardo Lander in Caracas and Nina Farnia, who is an election observer in Venezuela with the National Lawyers Guild. Then a bombshell Washington Post investigation. Did Donald Trump take a $10 million bribe from Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi days before Trump took office? We'll speak with the Washington Post reporter who broke the story, Carol Lenig. Stay with us. By Bangladeshi artist Shazan, one of the many new songs that are the soundtrack to the protests in Bangladesh. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Venezuela, where tensions rising over the contested results of the presidential election that took place just over a week ago. The incumbent president, Nicolas Maduro, who was declared the winner by Venezuela's National Electoral Council, has vowed to pulverize the U.S.-backed opposition, which has released thousands of vote tally sheets to back its claims that opposition candidate Edmundo Gonzalez received more than twice as many votes as Maduro. Countries including the U.S., Argentina, Uruguay, Costa Rica, and Ecuador have recognized Gonzalez as Venezuela's president-elect. But others have questioned the authenticity of the opposition's tally sheets, which Gonzalez and fellow opposition leader Maria Corina Machado said they secured from polling centers nationwide. Dueling protests continue in Caracas and other cities this weekend, both in support of Maduro and against him. Rights groups have denounced the crackdown on opposition protests, with Human Rights Watch estimating at least 20 people have been killed by Venezuelan armed forces. Maduro spoke from Caracas Saturday.
We have 2,000 prisoners captured. From there, they go to Tacuran and Tequito prisons. Maximum punishment. Justice. This time, there will be no forgiveness. This time, there will be Tacuran prison.
On Friday, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador criticized the Biden administration for recognizing Venezuelan opposition candidate Edmundo Gonzalez as president-elect.
Hacemos un llamado respetuoso.
We make a respectful appeal to all governments to ensure that there is no interventionism. No government is authorized. It is not legal. It is not legitimate to issue a ruling, giving victory or loss to a candidate from another country. What is that? There is no world government.
This all comes as the UN Refugee Agency estimates more than 7.7 million people have been forced to leave Venezuela since 2014, as sanctions imposed by the United States and European Union have devastated Venezuela's economy. For more, we're joined by two guests. In Caracas, Edgardo Lander is with us. He is a sociologist, where he is part of the Citizens Platform in Defense of the Constitution, part of a Latin American network of activists and academics called Eco-Social and Intercultural Pact of the South. And in Albany, New York, we're joined by Nina Farnia, a legal historian at Albany Law School. She's the co-founder of the International People's Tribunal on U.S. Imperialism and Sanctions. She just returned from Caracas, where she volunteered with the National Lawyers Guild as an election observer. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin in Caracas. Edgardo Lander, if you can explain what you think took place.
Good morning, Amy. Thanks for the invitation and the opportunity to talk to you and your audience. There is no doubt that Maduro was overwhelmingly defeated by these elections. the electoral system in Venezuela, it's the technical part of the system is probably one of the best in the world. There's hardly any possibility of interference with the results at the technical level. But there are many mechanisms incorporated into the system, including paper ballots that are printed and acts that are registered and signed by the witnesses at each voting booth that can be compared with the results presented by the totals of the Electoral Council. All the steps that secure the system, that are checks established in the system, were completely thrown out by the Electoral Council. They published a made-up data, so-called final results. They declared Maduro president before they had even finished counting. There were more than almost 3 million votes that hadn't been counted by the time they declared. And it is a fact that the witnesses at the voting booth have copies of what actually happened at each voting booth. And it's clear that this result, that these papers show that there was an overwhelming result. I directly know of several centers in that had been radically Chavistas up to some short time ago, where the results were against the government. This is really representative of a sentence of a tendency where even the most Chavista centers in the country voted against Maduro. So there's no doubt that Maduro lost these elections. Maduro has now decided to ask the Supreme Court to check the whole process again in order to figure out what's going on.
So let's go to Nina Farnia.
Edgardo,
we're going to get comment from Nina Farnia, a legal historian at Albany Law School. You're just back from Venezuela. You were an observer with the National Lawyers Guild. If you can talk about what you saw and respond to Edgardo Lander.
Well, thank you for having me on, Amy. What we witnessed by and large was a free and fair election process, which explains why former President Jimmy Carter once called this system the best electoral system in the world. We were part of a large international delegation of election monitors that included members of the African Union and the Latin American election experts. And we were quarantined with the rest of our delegation in a hotel that was separate from all the political activities. We attended days of trainings about the Venezuelan electoral system, about the laws that protect it. And then we were taken, prior to the elections, we were taken to polling stations around the country where we saw the touchscreen voting machines. We saw the ballot boxes for the paper ballots. We met the directors of each voting center. On the day of the election, our NLG delegation had the privilege of interviewing voters as they were going in and out of the voting room. And we also interviewed members of each of the parties that were there to monitor the elections, the polling stations. We also interviewed opposition voters. We didn't hear any concerns from any voters or observers. Every single person that we spoke with said that this is a free and fair process. They had faith in the system. And in fact, what we saw was a ton of energy around each of the stations that we visited. People were proud to vote. They view voting as a pillar of the Venezuelan democracy and of the Bolivarian Revolution.
And your sense of what had happened before, the polls showed that Gonzalez had won or was going to win by a landslide. Ultimately, what the Electoral Council announced was that, and of course we all know that polls can be very wrong, was that Maduro had won by 51%, Nina.
Yeah, so exit polling is illegal in Venezuela because it has the effect of altering votes. And also a lot of the polling results that were used in the U.S. media, the polling predictions that were used in the U.S. media were discredited by Venezuela Analysis, a trusted news source in Venezuela that has also been critical of the Maduro government. We actually are very concerned by the claim that González has won. González was a diplomat Venezuelan diplomat in El Salvador during the Salvadoran death squads. He was number two stationed there. He has blood on his hands. He has Salvadoran blood on his hands. And so the idea that the Venezuelans would support a government, a president who executed U.S. foreign policy in El Salvador decades ago is shocking to us. It's up ultimately to the Supreme Court to decide.
So, Edgardo Lander, you have said it's clear that Maduro lost. You are a leading left voice in Venezuela and globally, one of the early leaders of the World Social Forum. Even in the United States, when they were demanding that the ballots be shown the following morning, they are not available, for example, in the United States, what happens right after an election. In what way were these opposition-shown ballots verified by anyone but the opposition? And what do you say, Edgardo Lander, to those fellow leftists who say this is a result of longtime U.S. campaign to unseat Maduro, to destabilize his government with crushing sanctions?
In the first place, the demand to have public access to the ballots is not some weird demand that somebody made up. It's part of the controls that are established in Venezuelan laws. According to Venezuelan laws, the Electoral Council has to publicly present the ballots at each voting center, and it has absolutely denied to do so. So it's absolutely clear that they have presented a total result with no backing whatsoever. So the backing that's expected and it's established by the law is completely absent. The ballots that are in the hands of the González people are not the only ballots that are available, because different candidates and their witnesses get copies of the ballots at the voting centers. And all the ballots that are in the hands of these several other candidates show the same tendencies. They show the tendencies that there was an overwhelming majority of people voting against Maduro. I think that this is a test for the left internationally. If the left in many places of the world, in Latin America, in the United States, Europe, some sectors of the left continue to call the Venezuelan government as a revolutionary leftist government. If this repressive, authoritarian, corrupt, extractivist government that is destroying the environment and it's in constant violation of human rights is defined as left, if this is what's presented as the offer for the future of humanity, then it's clear that this left is contributing to increasing the appeal of the right wing and the far right wing. This has ceased to be a leftist government a long time ago. The conflict in Venezuela has not been, in this election, a conflict between left and right. It's a conflict between a repressive government and a whole spread of positions in Venezuelan society that go from far right to left, that includes social democrats, that includes progressives, that includes liberals. It includes a whole spread of people who want to recover democracy, who want to recover the constitution in Venezuela, which is completely violated by this increasingly authoritarian government. If this result is imposed on the Venezuelan society, this could be the nail on the coffin that will be the end result of these authoritarian tendencies that have been going on for quite some time and establish a truly authoritarian government. So it's very important for the left in Venezuela to get as much solidarity from the left internationally in the recognition that this is not U.S. conspiracy, that it's not fascism. We reject U.S. intervention. The United States has no right to decide who won the elections. This is an issue for Venezuelans to decide. And the United States has been intervening in Venezuela for a long time. Sanctions have had a dramatic impact on Venezuelan society. The humanitarian crisis and almost 8 million people that have left the country because they see no future are basically the result of U.S. intervention and U.S. sanctions. So it's not in any way a support for U.S. position.